Call to order this hearing of the State and Local Government Operations and Oversight Committee for Monday, March 16th, 2009. The first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes.
Madam Chair, also move.
Senator Betzel has moved that the minutes for Wednesday, March 11, 2009, be approved as presented. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. The first item on our agenda is Senate File 182, Senator Pogamiller.
We could have at least, where do we get one? Republican?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate File 182 is based on recommendations from the Redistricting Reform Commission. And you will recall last year sometime, the committee held a hearing. And we had Governor Ernie Carlson, Vice President Mondale, Senator Moe, former Governor Quay, former Secretary of State Joan Groh, former Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz, and Mr. Larry Jacobs from the university all testified on this topic in support of this bill and this approach. There is in your packet a letter from the former Vice President Mondale, signed by himself, Al Quy, Arnie Carlson, and Roger Moe in support of the bill as drafted. Since we had the hearing last year, Madam Chair, I felt it was not a good use of the committee's time to bring everybody back in. I just wanted to point out that there's broad bipartisan support for this general approach. There's two main features to Senate File 182. First section is redistricting principles, and these principles are based on both case law and Minnesota tradition for redistricting. And they are in order of priority because there's no principle that you can usually satisfy in and of itself without balancing with the other principles. And so the way Section 1 is constructed is that these principles are in the order of importance based on historical court actions and just basic good government. And so the first principle is nesting of House districts within the Senate districts. Equal population is second. Compactness and contiguity is third. Numbering of the districts is fourth. Minority representation is fifth. Preserving political subdivisions is sixth. That means don't try to avoid breaking up cities and counties if you can. Communities of interest comes after that. Try to keep what historically have been communities of interest based on housing patterns and type of activity in that community together. And then the last two criterias are relatively new political competitiveness. This is the one that a lot of the political scientists are arguing for nationally. It's by and large related to congressional redistricting because you have so few districts and there's a lot of research about how, I forget the exact figure, but like 92% of congressional districts now are just simply not competitive. Whereas in legislative redistricting, your competitiveness basically falls in the areas where there are population shifts. And so the competitiveness issue is really one more related to congressional, although it theoretically could have an effect on how you drew some state districts, some legislative districts also. And then the last criteria, you should not go out of your way to either protect or defeat an incumbent when you do a redistricting map. And again, those are priority order. They are based on case law and historical tradition of redistricting in Minnesota and around the country. The second section of the bill then, and the reason to get, on Section 1, the reason to get these criteria into law is that whoever draws the maps then will have a orderly kind of fairness-based set of criteria when they draw districts. And it's not a perfect science. You can't meet all these criteria 100%, but if you try to balance the criteria and do it in a priority order, you basically take a lot of the kind of bald partisanship out of map drawing, because then you've got to have reasons why you're drawing the maps the way you are. So to me, this section one is crucially important that we do, and even if along the line somebody decides we're not going to let a commission do this, we're going to have the legislature do it, I would still argue you should get these criteria into law. I also support section two, though, which is a redistricting commission. Under our Constitution, the legislature, by Constitution, has the final say over maps. And this, the way this is drafted, maintains that. What it says, though, is that a commission not directly interested in the drawing of the maps would do the drawing of the maps, and then the legislature would either say yes or no to the map. In the first two instances, when a panel of retired judges drew the maps, that's what this calls for, the legislature would vote just yay or nay based on the map and in its entirety. You would not be able to amend the map. If, though, the first two maps were rejected by the legislature, then on the third try, the legislature could reject the map and make alterations to it. I think the general assumption is you would never get to the third map, probably, because a panel-drawn map by retired judges would probably be done in a way in the first and second instance where the legislature would have enough votes to adopt the map. I think that common sense kind of dictates that. And so it's unlikely you would ever get to that third circumstance. So you'd have five retired judges, either an appellate or district court, who had never served either as a legislator or as a party-designated office holder. You couldn't be party chair of one of the parties. You could never have been a legislator. You could have never have been a endorsed candidate for mayor. And so the idea is to take as non-party-oriented judges as possible. The first four retired judges would be picked by the leaders of each caucus of the legislature, and then the fifth judge would be picked by those four judges. And hopefully they do it unanimously, but at least three of the four judges would have to choose the fifth judge. They then would pick their own chair, and they would adopt in subdivision 5 on page 3, lines 3.22, they would adopt a schedule to take testimony or actual maps proposed by others. So presumably, if people felt it was important, caucuses of the legislature could still produce their own maps and then present them to this panel. And that has been the historical mechanism. Each caucus of the legislature would draw up its own map. And in this instance, instead of going to voting on that immediately, you would present those maps to this five-member panel. Citizens could come up with their own maps. League of Cities could come up with its own map. The DFL party could come up with a map. The Republican Party, the Green Party. Everybody could come up with their own maps and present them either in total or just in testimony to this panel. This panel then would either draw their own maps or work off of a map presented to them by somebody else, and then come up with certain dates outlined in the statute, point 3.28, in the first year before the election, so a year and a half before the election, provide a map to the legislature to vote yay or nay on. I won't go through all the specifics of that. You can read that for yourself. That's the general outline, Madam Chair. I would try to answer questions. Again, you can never totally take the politics out of redistricting, because it is a political with a small p activity. People who know their communities have thoughts about what our community is of interest, and so there's no absolutely non-political way to do this, I suppose, unless you just had a computer do it. But removing this from the direct map drawing of those immediately interested, which are legislators, probably gives more credibility to the map and probably speeds up the process. And again, you don't take it totally out of the hands of the legislature, because the Constitution does give us final authority. And that's why you can do this by law rather than by constitutional amendment. And I think the way it's set up, though, you would have a map drawn by this panel, either in the first instance or the second instance, that would be adopted by the legislature. That is the most likely outcome. If the map for some, if the five-judge panel somehow gets ultra-partisan, there may not be the votes in the legislature to pass a bill. And in that instance, in the end, the legislature would draft its own bill or modify whatever the court gave it. And that's not different than the current system. And then you could end up with the Supreme Court reviewing your bill anyway. This is an attempt to try to get a bill that does not have to go through judicial review because there's general acceptance of it. And that should speed it up and also take some of the contentiousness out of it. Madam, I would stand
Thank
for
Thank you, Senator Pogamiller. We're going to take testimony, even though we've heard testimony before, if people want to come and speak to it. But in Section 2, you have the, in terms of the timelines, March 1st is when the members would need to be appointed, and then by May 15th, submit the first plan. However, you don't have a requirement for when the first meeting of the group would take place, whereby they would select that fifth member. And I wonder if on, and this is all in transparency, in the name of transparency, et cetera, doing things in the public to the degree that they can, if in subdivision 4, that you would call upon the executive director of the LCC just to convene the first meeting, and then they could, and we would have put a date certain in there
that
their work would get done. And I asked Mr. Botter and Mr. Watson to suggest a date by which that first meeting must be held so that their work can begin and their chairman elected. Is that?
That'd be an excellent addition, yes.
Okay. Mr. Bodern, do you have some language or Mr. Watson?
Madam Chair, in consulting with Mr. Watson, he suggested March 15th, 2010.
The amendment would read, the executive director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission shall convene the first meeting by March 10.
March 15th. Madam Chair, perhaps March 15th, 2010.
March 15th, because I'm also
Where
concerned.
Where would you put it? Where would you put it?
Well, I'm looking at Subdivision 4, Senator Pogamiller, but we'd also want.
Okay.
They would have to come at that first meeting to choose the fifth judge.
Wouldn't you put this in on line 313?
Well, since the LCC was providing the administrative support, I thought maybe there would be the place to say the ED would convene the first meeting. And further, I think that up in at 313, where you say the four judges thus appointed shall by a vote of at least three judges choose the fifth judge at the commission's first meeting. I mean, you want them to move right along here. And then selecting one of their members to serve as chair of the commission also at the first meeting. And that's not particularly elegant how I've stated it, but I think that that's what we need to accomplish here so that the expectations of how this group is going to function will be crystal clear. So do we have some suggested amendment? Or shall we take some testimony or answer some other questions while you're working on the amendment? Is that okay, Senator Pogamiller?
Good.
And are you okay with?
Those are both excellent suggestions.
Okay. Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we have a number of dates here in Subdivision 7 as well, too. And, of course, this is a proposal that would only happen once every maybe 10 years, so I think we have to be a little cognizant. You know, when we have a recurring, something happens every single year, the date may matter less. I do note May 15th for 2011 is going to be on a Sunday. So as a practical matter, if we're talking about the commission submitting the plan, you know, just be aware that that date would fall on a Sunday, as well as on 3.32, January 15th, 2012, is also on a Sunday. So that may or may not. So as a practical effect, those things would have to be done, I assume, prior to that date. My other question, though, on the deadline on January 10th, 15th, excuse me, on page 3, line 32, that would be the second year of the biennium, and typically the legislature isn't convened for the second year until maybe February or possibly early March. I suppose the legislature could convene to meet that deadline, but that would be an extraordinary circumstance. I just wonder if that was taken into consideration.
Senator Pogamilla, you might there just say by the in 332, by the first day of session.
Mm-hmm.
In the year ending in 2,
except
because we couldn't act on it any sooner than that. They could present it sooner, but we wouldn't act on it sooner than that first day.
However, Madam Chair, then the third plan, though, if the second plan is rejected, the bill says on page 4, line 2, that the third one has to be done by February 1st, which would be 2 weeks afterwards. So perhaps it would be available by the first day or the first week of session, and then 2 weeks later would be the third plan.
Yes. Senator Pogamilla?
Yes, that's a good idea, and I think that May 15th should be moved up also to April 30th or something, because you don't want it to be 2 days before session ends.
Right. And I, Senator Betzel, I think the specific dates in some places are okay if they fall on Friday or Sunday, because we do say, you know, a report to be handed in by January 15th, and we don't pay any attention to whether that's on a Sunday. It just means it has to be in by then. It doesn't have to be in on that day, just by that day.
Well, I appreciate it, but this, Madam Chair, is so specific because it's going to happen in 2011 and 2012 and not again for another 10 years. So I think for this time we should be very sensitive to what the dates are, because they may affect some other matters.
And then if this is found to be successful and occurs again in 2020, the legislature would have the time to adjust the dates that fit better for 2020.
Yes.
So I think it's a good idea to make these as specific here as possible. So we're looking at the changes to who convenes the first meeting, what happens at that first meeting, the selection of the fourth judge, of the fifth judge, and the election of the chair. And then on the deadlines, Senator Pogamiller is suggesting April 30th on 3:30.
I think you can leave the January 15th, because if we're not in session, this is just submitting the plan. The key is when the other plan would come.
Okay, but when... when does your bill require the legislature to act on it?
It doesn't, but if they have to submit it by January 15th, then let's say the legislature comes in February 1st.
Okay.
The legislature doesn't get a bite at the third plan or a chance to modify it until they've rejected the second plan.
So you would need to, on 4-2, change that date.
Correct. That's the one that has to be changed.
Okay, so if we leave line 332 the way it is, change 330 to April 30th, and then say if the commission fails to submit a plan either of those two deadlines, okay, then that works.
Within 2 weeks after plan 2 is rejected. would work, something like that.
Senator Batson.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Pogba, I think you should put the onus on the legislature to take a vote within the 2 weeks after convening the session in the second year.
Okay.
Not just say 2 weeks after, because this may be delayed until, 2 months into the session. I think you want the legislature to take a vote as quickly as possible within those first 2 weeks. And if the legislature doesn't take a vote, then Plan 2 goes into effect.
No.
They get a third chance. What if the legislature doesn't do anything in action? Then
there'll be no plan. By Constitution, the legislature has to adopt a plan.
Oh, okay.
And it's not in the legislature's interest not to adopt a plan.
So they submit a report, a plan for... legislative and congressional seats by April 30th of 2011. And the legislature acts on that plan before the end of session in 2011. So like by May 17th or something, the constitutional deadline. Then, if they do not accept it, then they have until January 15th to submit a new plan, a second plan, and the legislature there's the caveat that if the commission fails to submit a plan, the legislature may act on its own. If the second plan is rejected by the legislature, and we need a date in there within, legislature must act on the second plan within 2 weeks after session has convened. If they reject it within that 2 weeks, then they would submit a third plan, and with that, they may accept, reject, or modify, and that's when we need another date.
Give them 2 more weeks. It's about 2 weeks.
So following the rejection of the if the legislature fails to accept the plan 2, then the commission has 2 weeks to submit the third plan.
Correct.
And then the legislature will act further on that with no deadline, because it's either to their interest to adopt one or not.
Right. And what will happen is someone will file a motion with the courts to say there's going to be an election and the legislature isn't getting its work done,
and then the
court will appoint a panel.
And then we'll go to the courts.
The court will, right. So there's no danger that there will never be a plan.
Plan, right. So do we need to take some testimony or have some questions answered before we get that amendment, gentlemen? Or is it ready?
Madam Chair, I have a suggestion for the one bit of language.
Okay.
Which would be page 3, line 12, after the period, insert, the director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission shall convene a meeting of the four judges no later than March 15th, or whatever date you want, March 15th of that year, comma, at which meeting, I'll read it again, the director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission shall convene a meeting of the four judges no later than March 15 of that year, comma, at which meeting.
Then continue the four judges.
Four judges thus appointed shall, by a vote of at least three judges, choose the fifth judge.
Okay. So the first meeting would have to be by March 15th. At which time of the four, at which point? Senator Pogba Miller, is that acceptable?
That's excellent.
To you? Senator Lori moves that amendment. Is it clear to all? All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Now, with regard to the timeline, Mr. Watson.
Madam Chair, on page 3, line 30, delete May 15 and insert April 30th. Okay. And then I'm afraid I haven't figured out yet how to say what you wanted to say.
We want the plan presented by January 15th, the legislature to act on it within a period of 2 weeks after session has convened. The commission to submit the third plan within 2 weeks after the, if the legislature rejects the second plan, the commission has 2 weeks to submit a third plan, and at that point, the legislature, if it rejects it, comes up with its own plan or no plan. And the, Senator Pogue-Miller mentioned there would be a motion to go to the courts. Senator Roebling.
I've only been around through one redistricting and it went to the courts, so I'm not quite sure how this works. But doesn't the governor have any role in this at all?
No.
So he can't, he or she couldn't veto it?
Oh, he has a
role. Oh, yes, yes. The role is if the legislature passes the plan, the governor can sign it or veto it. If the governor vetoes it, then there's no law, and that sets in motion either another plan by the legislature. Or if there's not another plan, then the courts get into action because someone has to do a plan.
Senator Roebling, of course, the legislature will act on this proposal.
Presumably, if the five-judge panel came up with a plan that the legislature adopted, in all likelihood, a governor would sign that. Not necessarily, but in all likelihood.
But it's never been the case that the governor comes up with a redistricting plan. That's not the function, and that function is spelled out in the Constitution.
Madam Chair, I just wasn't sure if it was like a constitutional amendment, which doesn't require the signature of the governor to go on the ballot. I wasn't sure.
The legislature proposes, which is just the reverse with the governor proposing a budget, and we act on it. The legislature proposes a redistricting plan, and the governor says yes or no. Senator Lori?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along the same line, though, I wonder if it should say if it's rejected by the legislature or the governor. You know, do we want to, if the governor were to veto Plan 1, do we want this commission to still come up with Plan 2? If the governor vetoes it... And this wouldn't actually call for that, it doesn't seem. So if it is, I'm looking at line 331, rejected by the legislature or vetoed by the governor, that would then trigger the second plan, and presumably it would, on 335.
Right now, the way the bill reads, it would be if the plan were accepted by the governor, accepted by the legislature, and vetoed by the governor, then the commission would be moot. We'd go right to the third point, which is the legislature comes up with its own plan and negotiates with the governor.
What time is it?
How does that work in other states, Mr. Watson? If the legislature endorses a plan, this kind of staggered plans, endorses a plan, votes for it, and a governor vetoes that work of the independent commission, what do other states do? Do they just leave it to the legislature, or does the independent commission still have a role?
Madam Chair, I don't know, but I don't think that that's ever happened. This schedule is similar to the schedule that Iowa uses, and they've gotten to their third plan, but they've not had a plan that was adopted by the legislature and rejected by the governor. And Maine has a similar system for presenting a plan to the legislature, and I don't think that's ever been rejected by the governor.
So, Senator Lurie, that might be theoretically possible, but in all practicality, it doesn't happen.
That's and
fine. Senator Pogue-Miller?
The legislature could choose to override.
Right.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Watson.
One of the problems I'm having with the deadlines is that there's nothing that prevents the from the commission from submitting a plan before one of these deadlines. Right. And there's nothing that compels the legislature to wait a long time before taking action on it. So I could foresee the commission submitting a plan, maybe not much before April 30th, but certainly well before the end of the session. And the legislature, if it didn't like the plan, I could see it rejecting it rather quickly. Mm-hmm. And the commission perhaps coming up with a second plan, even a third plan, before May 18th. So I was trying to figure out how to talk about imposing a deadline on a second plan that relates to the second year of the biennium when that might not be when this is all happening.
But Mr. Watson, it would just, you could submit it. They get it in by April 30th. We vote on it May 1st. They could, with this language, submit a new plan right away, a week later. And the legislature would be free to act on it or not, but the legislature would be compelled to act on it by 2 weeks following January 15th of the year ending in 2. They wouldn't necessarily have to act on it in 01 if we added that 2 weeks after the, 2 weeks after the legislature convenes in year 2.
Again, Madam Chair, the difficulty I have with 2 weeks after it convenes is that it's totally up to the legislature to decide whether they're going to convene on January 2nd or 3rd or the 1st of March.
But that's why we wouldn't put – the plan would have to be submitted by January 15th, but the action on the plan would only be within 2 weeks after the legislature has convened, but no earlier than – I guess we'd have to say no earlier than
But see, if they convened 30. On January 2nd, yeah. And within 2 weeks the commission is just barely going to be submitting a plan, and now their deadline for approving it is expired.
Then I think it has to be but no later than January.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair.
I think we know what we want to have this orderly succession of – Once the commission acts, then the legislature is compelled to act within a certain period of time. It's not just the onus is not just on the commission to get the plans to the legislature. Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, rather than specifying the dates, maybe we should just put a time period in saying, I mean, the first one is fine. I mean, saying we have to have the first plan by April 30th.
Okay.
Now, and Mr. Watts is correct. They could turn around and maybe have a new plan within 2 or 3 days, or it might take a while. But maybe we should just say they've got 2 weeks to get a new plan out. Now, the legislature could well adjourn for the year by then.
Right.
But at least we give them a certain amount of time to come back. Then the legislature has some time. And as I say, at some point, we are going to go from 2011 into 2012. But the clock is going to stop until whenever the legislature comes back, and the clock starts running again for the legislature to do something, and then, you know, after that, the second plan is accepted or rejected or whatever happens, and the third time kicks in. But so rather than having specific timelines, deadlines, maybe we should just put in the amount of time we've got to act, realizing you might be crossing in, you know, into legislative years to do that. But I don't know any other way, because we are right at the edge no matter what we do here.
So what would you suggest?
Well, Madam Chair, I would suggest, first of all, leaving on page 3, you know, the April 30th is correct, and just leaving that in there, because that would be, I think we need a date when the first plan is to be due. If a plan is submitted, and then say if the plan is submitted, is rejected by the legislature, the commission shall submit a second plan of approval or rejection, but not for modification, within 2 weeks. I don't know what's a reasonable amount of time. I don't know if 2 weeks is the right amount of time or not. Within 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, I don't know. If we say within a month, that could be within 2 days, but it could be within a month. Instead of tying it to January 15th. And I guess I need a little bit of guidance as to how long we think the commission is going to need for its second plan. And then if the commission fails to meet, I think the next line is okay. If the second plan is rejected by the legislature, the commission shall submit a third plan, which must be accepted, rejected, or modified by the legislature, again, within 2 weeks, 3 weeks after the second plan was accepted or rejected.
And that's just not time on the calendar, but legislative days.
Madam Chair, that's correct, because, again, I can easily foresee the legislature either getting this done in the first year by us not tying it to specific days. I can also see us running out of time in the first year, and it just, as I say, the clock stops. And it starts again when the second year session convenes, whenever that date is.
So what you're suggesting is we only need to change May 15th to April 30th, strike line 332 by January 15th of the year ending in 2, and insert within 2 weeks, and then on line 42, which is the submission of the third plan, within 2 weeks of the second plan is rejected by the legislature, the commission shall submit a third plan within 2 weeks again.
And Madam Chair, and
that works.
We may need a sentence to simply acknowledge the fact that this may have to go from one legislative year into the other one. When we're talking 2 weeks, we recognize that we lose jurisdiction when we reach that third Monday of May, and it may have to go into the second year. And you know, I mean, when
doesn't,
we say 2 weeks,
no,
we,
it doesn't change anything. This is just submission of a plan. So whether we're in session or not doesn't matter.
Okay, within 2 weeks.
So, Senator Pogamiller, is that
I think
those
that
changes
works.
Work?
Okay. But if you reject the plan. Trust me, the legislature is going to be trying to do this.
Yes.
Because otherwise the courts are going to do it.
Right. So, Senator Betzel, do you want to make that into a motion? We want to get on with this.
Right, yes.
Getting in the weeds here.
Madam Chair, I was just thinking that maybe Senator Pogamiller is going to have one of those lifelines ex-Senator Gene Merriam to
yeah, call him on that.
Madam Chair, yes, I'll make that motion. And I think there may be a glitch or two here that needs to be cleared up, but this bill has to go to the Rules Committee, and I think there's going to be ample time to clean it up.
If we make that change here, that at least the Rules Committee will see the direction that we were going, and if there is some conflict, they can further refine it.
I have
there.
Confidence in the Rules Committee, Madam Chair, so I'll make that.
So
motion.
Senator Betzel moves on line 330 to strike May 15, insert April 30. On line 332 to strike the comma by January 15th of the year ending in 2 and insert within 2 weeks, and then on line 4-2 to indicate which may be accepted, rejected, or modified by the legislature within 2 weeks, or must submit a third plan within 2 weeks, I'm sorry, to insert after the word plan, which may be accepted, rejected, or modified by the legislature, and then strike line 4-2.
So moved.
Mr. Watson?
And Madam Chair, did you also want to add the word suggested by Senator Lurie on page 3, line 31, after legislature, insert, or vetoed by the governor?
Senator Pogemiller had objected to that because the legislature could override the veto. So to just be silent on that, I thought. Senator Pogemiller, correct?
Yeah.
So we have the Betzel motion in front of us. Any questions? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Now, questions to Senator Pogemiller about the general direction of this proposal, and then if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to speak to it, we will hear from them. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pogemiller, as I was reading through this order of priorities of principles, it seems that minority representation and communities of interest are very similar. And because we're asking in the communities of interest to try and keep groups together that are of social, political, cultural, ethnic, or economic interests. And the one above it, you know, is more of a minority racial or language. But some of those very things, social, cultural, ethnic, are very similar or the same in my view. And so I'm wondering about the minority representation. I know that it is one of the requirements of the courts for congressional districts. For both, I thought it was there. It was never ruled on for legislative, but for congressional.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pogemiller.
There's a lot of case law and Supreme Court action around this. It's there was just a case just recently, and it's all related to the Voting Rights Act. And there was just a case recently that the Supreme Court altered slightly the balance here. The court just decided that the need to place minorities in one district on voting strength, if it doesn't reach 50% of voting strength, that the criteria might be slightly different. But there's a this has been litigated a lot. So it does not only deserve, but it needs to have special consideration in your criteria.
Chair, well, it's just getting it twice, it looks like, in many ways.
Well, Madam Chair, communities of interest is a much looser thing. The city of Montgomery should be with the city of New Ulm because of their German heritage.
And I'm sure he's got that mixed up. New Ulm should be with, or New Prague should be with Montgomery because they're Czech.
Okay. So that's a lot different than that type of community of interest is a lot different than the issue of racial minorities.
Any other questions from the members? Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pogemiller, on lines 3.23 and 3.24, it says that the commission can or shall adopt a schedule for interested persons to submit proposed
plans.
On
page 3, lines sub 5.
3, okay. I thought you said 2. Okay. I got it.
I'm wondering about that second clause where it says, and to respond to plans proposed by others. What is that?
There is a hearing. There's 3 public hearings required here, and presumably whoever wants to can present a plan to the panel and say, here's something I think you ought to consider. Or sometimes people come in with one particular district in mind, New Prague and Montgomery, and say, when you draw this map, you should be thinking about the community of interest of the Czechs in this particular neighborhood.
Right. So, which I understand, Senator Pogemiller, but it seems like it's suggesting that the commission shall respond to the plans, where it says, and to respond to plans proposed by others. So I'm wondering if you
what
might...
What line is that on?
3.23 to 3.24.
It is adopting a schedule for people to submit plans and a schedule to respond to plans proposed by others.
Yeah, so they don't respond to a plan, they respond to the schedule.
Respond to each other's plans.
And there will be a lot of individual plans printed because with a laptop
anybody
technology,
can do it.
Pretty much anybody who wants can draw a plan. That's the situation for the next go-around.
Senator Pogamiller, I noted in the letter of support from the League of Women Voters that they were cautionary about using retired non-partisan members of the court for the appellate court and the district court, I guess, too, for the people on the commission, and instead supported more having just members of the public. Do you have any response to that?
I've seen the letter, actually.
Oh, it's coming right away. It's in the second paragraph.
Madam Chair, this is a balancing act. I think the commission that brought this idea forward felt that retired judges brought a certain amount of gravitas and signaled lack of partisanship. So I think sticking with the judges makes sense. It's really a question of at what level do you believe you're taking as much politics out of it as you can? Because there's always going to be politics. Even judges have some partisan background. They vote, so they may not be public in their partisanship. A commission that has other persons on it could work, so I would leave that up to the committee. But on balance, it just seems like where do you stop? It's only a five-person commission, and to some extent, the legislature is your most representative group.
Well, Senator Pogamiller, I wanted to draw that to your attention, but I personally agree with the bill as it's written in that regard, because you specifically state that no one may be considered who ever ran for a partisan office, like a legislator that became a judge, and those are legion, but that there isn't an error of taking in information and making judgments that judges become experienced in doing that may not be the experience of just members of the public who may have had very much more partisan involvement. So I think members need to consider this, but I, for one, support the
Mentor,
retired
judge. I would just say that almost anybody's going to be able to present a map to the judges, to the retired judges, and so that's one way in which they can present their testimony.
Who are as partisan as
correct.
Possible. Right.
Correct. And then, in addition, the legislature is going to be voting on this, so people can petition their individual legislator to be either for or against the map, based on whatever they feel is the correct thing. So I think there is opportunity for adequate citizen input. What you're really doing is setting up a panel that's kind of this independent.
As you can manage. Okay. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak to Senate File 182? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 182, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules.
Finance.
The Committee on Finance first, okay. All who may be in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill will be sent to Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the committee made some improvements in the bill, and I appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you. Senator Higgins. Senator Higgins, you're so patient. Thank you for sticking with us.
It's not my usual nature, Madam Chair.
Oh, I doubt that. Senator Higgins, First Class Cities Major, Political Party Caucuses, Privileges, Application.
And Madam Chair, in the interim between when this was heard in this election subcommittee, in work with the House author, we discovered that the language that we had originally seen in the election subcommittee would have required that no municipality, nobody in the entire state, could have a meeting at the same time Minneapolis or St. Paul's precinct caucuses were held. So we have the A2 amendment to try to get ourselves out of that.
Senator Higgins and Senator Seidman, we will just set aside the subcommittee report on this bill, too, since it is so vastly different from the bill that we passed in the subcommittee. So we're not taking up the subcommittee report, but instead we are considering the delete everything amendment.
And Madam
since
Chair,
we did have since we did have that discussion there, I'm not going to treat it as an author's amendment.
Oh, that's
but
fine.
I would but if you would explain it, then we can act on it right away.
And Madam Chair, to start with, if I could do a couple of grammatical changes.
Sure.
One on 1.22, move the only to after the word city. And on line 1.33, move the word only to after the word applies. That would make me happier as an English major.
Okay, would you explain the amendment, and we will incorporate the changes, and Senator Lori will move the amendment with the changes you suggested incorporated, and we have it before us now if you would like to explain it.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. This bill would change the statute that's related to precinct caucuses to deal with the off-year precinct caucuses that are held in our first-class cities. St. Paul has had them for many years. Minneapolis just recently had its second off-year precinct caucuses for city council, mayoral, park board, those kinds of local races. And the purpose of the bill was to get some of the same requirements and considerations for those precinct caucuses as we have in the legislative years. For example, cities and counties, school boards, those types of things are not supposed to hold meetings on the same nights that precinct caucuses are. We also say in statute that if a facility rents out its space for meetings like a precinct caucus, that we want it to be at the lowest rate that they charge. That's existing law in for the legislative years. We would like the same thing for the local or the municipality precinct caucuses. So rather than the original law, which was just a statement that, you know, section this and this and this and this also apply, those sections are now spelled out in the A2 amendment. And they'll look very familiar to you because they're the same as what we have in legislative.
Hey, is the amendment clear to members?
Sure.
Senator Roebling, you have a question?
I want to ask about lines 1.23 to 1.25. And it says, the two largest major political parties shall be the parties whose candidates for governor receive the greatest and second greatest number of votes in the most recent election. And I'm thinking of the year that Governor Ventura got elected. And I know in my area, that would mean that the Democrats wouldn't be a major party. Now, in these first-class cities, I imagine that it would mean that a Republican wouldn't be considered a major party. Because of the Independence Party, and the Democrats would have gotten it in the first-class cities, I think. But I'm wondering why you're only doing two when a situation like that could easily occur again.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, do we actually have a third party this year? Or do we have a viable third party in ongoing these days?
Minneapolis wouldn't.
In Minneapolis, it's the Greens. The Greens have more, you know, would.
Remember, this
if we
only,
had
this
set
only
up,
applies in the cities of the Trans.
And it was a way, actually, to, rather than saying, you know, who is the second party in Minneapolis, if you did it by who were on the city council or who has the mayor's job, the Greens would be the second party because we have no Republicans on our city council. And this was just a way of saying that, you know, that one particular race would be the governing one.
And
more often than not, it would be the Democrats and the Republicans.
Yeah, and Senator Higgins, this wouldn't preclude minor parties from having their precinct caucuses on the same night, but I know in the last election cycle, I think it was the Independence Party had their caucuses on some other date. They didn't want to have them on that.
They tend to
same
do
time.
A Saturday, Madam Chair.
And so this sets up who gets to decide, as opposed to other parties are welcome to hold their caucuses on those nights. So if in Minneapolis the two major parties ended up being the Democrats and the Greens, then the Republicans and the Independents and whoever else wanted to hold caucuses would certainly be able to hold their caucuses, I think the intent is, on that night with the same privileges. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And where does it say that after the dates have been, are you?
Madam Chair, it actually says that the chairs of the two largest major parties would get together and decide what date they would hold precinct caucuses and submit that to the governing body of the city. And if they don't, if they choose not to jointly submit that, then for the purposes of this, the first Tuesday in February would be considered precinct caucuses, and anybody who wanted to could hold them at that.
Okay,
time.
So they would agree, but if they didn't agree, then the default date would be that first February and first Tuesday in February.
Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Well, then on the back side, however, in order for someone who is not a major party candidate or caucus or party, major political party. So, and I'm assuming we're still going by the definition of the two that got the most votes in the last gubernatorial election, then they wouldn't necessarily be excused from work. They couldn't use the public school buildings at no charge, and the other facilities at no charge.
But, Madam Chair, it does, Senator
Higgins.
Roebling, it doesn't say, it does not limit these back of the page subdivisions to those two major parties that made the decision on what day to have the caucuses. Because
but
the major
it does
party
say
is
that if they don't, if the
party.
Independence Party wanted to have theirs on a Friday afternoon, if they wanted the privileges that are in lines, starting with lines 126, they would have to have their precinct caucus on the same night that the major party precinct caucuses were held. They want to have it on some other night, then they don't get those prohibitions by school board meetings not taking place.
So
as long as they participate with the major party caucuses, they get the same privileges.
So Madam Chair, just to make sure I understand this. So that D starting on 1.23 is only for choosing the date of the caucus. And then when we're speaking about major political party in subdivision 4 or 5 or 6, that we're saying anybody, it could be 4 or 5. What do we define as major political parties there?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it's political parties who receive more than 5% in some race, and I'm not sure who still is a major party and who isn't. Maybe one of the Senate Council knows.
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
I believe that the Independence Party, I believe, would still be because Dean Barkley ran statewide in the last election, so they think that qualified the Independence Party. I'm not sure where the Green Party is statewide, but and again, Madam Chair, I think we could remember that as recently as last year, I think it's been determined that, you know, although state law can determine these issues that, you know, these entities that cannot meet in conflict with the caucuses, state law cannot direct the parties when they're to have them. And parties as recently as last year ignored the law because we decided we want to have caucus a different night. Even the law said we're supposed to be in March. We said, well, we're going to move to February. So because the caucuses belong to the parties, not something that's directed by the state law. So we're just making an accommodation here for them if they choose to have it that night, but nothing requires any political party to have it that night.
Okay, so do we understand the A2 amendment? Senator Lori moves the A2 amendment with the changes suggested by Senator Higgins incorporated in it. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there further discussion, since this now is the bill, is there further discussion on Senate File 284 as amended? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 284? Seeing none, Senator Lori moves that Senate File 284, as amended, be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much.
Senator Berglund is not here. Senator Gimsey is not here. Oh, and then we come to me.
Want me to present it for him? Want me to present it for him? It looks pretty substantial here.
Senator Gimsey, are you an author on the bill? No, it's just him. We'll have to wait for him. I can do mine, I guess. I think these other bills are going to take a little bit of time, and Senator Berglund's bill is just a shell. So we're going to wait, and then take that up. Or how about I'll start with Senate File 1544, and when Senator Berglund enters the room, we'll lay 1544 over, take her bill up, and then come back to it. Is that agreeable? Okay.
Madam Chair?
Here she is. Sure.
short walk.
Senate File 3, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 3 is a very general bill eliminating state mandates. More of an intent language is included in the bill than anything else. I understand that at some point many of the other efforts that are going on will be folded into this bill. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions of members? Senator Betzold?
Just a question, Senator Berglund. As I'm looking at the bill, I think that the first sentence is probably both unnecessary and redundant. It says to ensure the public service is delivered cost-effective as necessary is the intent of the legislature to eliminate unnecessary state regulations. I think that if we just start the bill on page 1, line 7, by July 1st, et cetera, it all says the same thing. And the first sentence, I don't know that really adds anything to it.
If you wanted to delete that,
okay.
I have
Madam,
no.
Mr. Chair, I'll move to delete the first sentence, starting on page 1, line 5, through line 6, and line 7 through the period. I don't know if the head note needs to be modified or not. I guess I'll leave that to council, but that's my motion.
Senate Council have any? That's fine. Senator Betzold moves to essentially eliminate the first sentence in Section 1, Subdivision 1. Everyone understand the amendment? All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Any other questions or comments from members? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 3, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to or laid on the table.
No.
What are we doing?
I think this
referred to finance.
Either finance or rules, one of the two.
Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 3, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to finance. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Berglund. Senator Gimsey, Senate File 1298.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Senate File 1289 is an agency bill.
98?
Pardon me? 98, excuse me. Senate File 1298 is an agency bill that names two combined agencies, the Minnesota Department of Employee Relations, the Minnesota Department of Finance, as the Minnesota Management and Budget Department. With me is Deputy Commissioner Stephanie Andrews. With MMB to explain the name change and the bill.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Andrews. State your name for the record and offer your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Stephanie Andrews, Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Finance, hopefully soon to be renamed Minnesota Management and Budget. As the Senator said, in June of this year, or 2007, the former Department of Employee Relations and the Department of Finance merged into a single agency. In August, the Management Analysis and Development Division from the Department of Administration was also transferred in by reorganization order. And through that process of merging, we worked closely with our employees to talk about what a new mission statement and agency vision might look like for the new agency. Out of that process, we heard many things about what the agency should focus on, largely resulting in a greater focus on enterprise management issues, and we'll continue to work on fulfilling that through our work on information systems and analysis. One of the things that we did hear from our employees loud and strong was that what they really wanted was to be sure that the new name for the agency was something different than either finance or employee relations. So after we looked at what other state agencies across the country who had similar configurations of functions, many of them had adopted something like management and budget, and we decided that that also would be an appropriate name for the combined agency. So the bill before you basically puts that, makes employee relations and finance obsolete, and puts the new name of Minnesota Management and Budget into law.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Andrews. Any questions of members? Senator Olsen?
Is there a fiscal note for all the paperwork changes and changes on buildings and that kind of stuff?
Senator Gimsey, Ms. Andrews?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, there is not. We basically have been doing all that we can to use up anything that we have around. You may have seen the commissioner on the economic update. We have been putting stickers over our old Department of Finance paper so that we can use it up. And we're then, as we go forward, doing relatively small batches of things until this new name is finalized.
Thank you. Any other questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Gimsey recommends that Senate File 1298 be recommended to pass and referred to
Finance.
They've requested, Finance has requested it.
Okay.
So,
very good.
Senator Gimsey so moves. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Gimsey. Senator Rest, just to finish up Senate File 1544.
Mr. Chairman and members, Senate File 1544 reflects the work in the main done by Senator Lori, Senator Gerlach, and myself in a response to the recommendations coming from the various local governments for mandate relief. This bill will go to the Committee on Finance, where it will be, to the extent that we act on it today, it will become part of Senator Berglund's bill, one article of her bill, and then other committees, policy committees, finance committees that have been working on the same subject matter in their particular category, like education, for example, will add items to Senator Berglund's bill so that we will have a kind of an omnibus mandate relief bill in the before the Senate. We have some I have some amendments to offer to the bill, and the first one is, and I don't, do I have my summary? The first one that I would ask is to remove, is to delete Section 8. Mr. Chairman, that's an author's amendment.
Senator Rest moves to delete Section 8 as an author's amendment from Senate File 1544. Everyone understand? All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chairman, on another amendment to this, on Section 7, to on line 419, to delete, and 419 and 421, to delete 5,000 and insert 2,000. This is, it's raising the floor on where you need to start, or ceiling, where you need to start reporting from $300 to $2,000. We had originally in the bill proposed a tenfold increase, but we're asked to reconsider that, and so we have it at 2,000.
Senator Rust moves as an author's amendment to amend Section 7 on lines 419 and 421, replacing the 5,000 with 2,000. All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Then, Mr. Chairman, the A2 amendment. The counties had asked us to consider giving them some flexibility with regard to their work week. And
we have an A2 before us yet.
We've got 3, 4, 5.
We have an A3 and an A4 if you want to take those.
Okay, there's one that goes along with that, but.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, that's incorporated in A6.
It's incorporated in the A6. Okay. Let's take the A6 amendment then.
We don't have the A6 before us either. It's coming.
It's coming. I see now. Yeah. The A6 amendment then would allow counties to operate on a 4-day work week rather than being required to operate on a 5-day work week. And it establishes in Section 9 of the amendment, starting at lines 118 through 123, to say that it to be done in coordination with the bargaining units within the county, so that everyone is on board with that, and it would be subject to collective bargaining. So, Mr. Chairman, I would offer the A6 amendment.
Senator Rust moves the A6 author's amendment. We'll adopt these amendments and then have the bill described, if that's all right with members. We're going to get through the amendments, have the bill in shape as author's amendments, and then cover the bill.
I have a question on the amendment.
It's an author's amendment, and we're going to get them all. We're going to get the bill in shape and then take all the questions on the bill. Is that members amenable to that? Senator Rust moves the A6 author's amendment. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Then, Mr. Chairman, the A3 amendment, we have in the bill a similar provision for with regard to cemeteries for counties, and the townships asked to be included under that same privilege, that is, that they may prohibit further burials in an abandoned cemetery and not have to accept responsibility for new burials. And it's already in the bill for counties, and we're in Section 4, and we're adding that privilege also for townships.
Excellent. Senator Rust moves the A3 author's amendment. All those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
And, Mr. Chairman, then the A4 amendment has to deal, this is also coming as a suggestion from Senator Scoy out of his bill with regard to law library fees, and it allows a county, just reading through it, to transfer to the general fund any portion of the library fees that exceeds a certain limit, 125%, of the amount received during the preceding calendar year. And then that amount can be used to pay for county attorneys' cases and CHIPS cases. So it's a way of using some excess funds in CHIPS cases before the county, being brought by the county attorney. Mr. Chairman, I'd move that amendment.
Senator Rust moves the A4 author's amendment. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I have the A5 amendment, but I'm going to set that aside and have the committee discuss whether that is appropriate to go on this bill. I will tell you that it, in terms of being a mandate relief, that it is a provision to increase the fees for deputy registrars. I think there are a number of us that maybe support this, but we need to discuss whether it would be, whether actually it is mandate relief. So I'm not going to offer that as an author's amendment.
Okay. Would you like to offer it now, or would you like
no.
to describe the bill?
No, I want to go
describe
back to the
bill.
Maybe
cover the amendments,
Mr. Chairman,
that were already offered.
We took suggestions from counties, townships, cities, and their the written documents that they had produced, went through them as to what we thought were reasonable proposals. In some instances, we modified what their suggestions were, and then have a bill that I think at this point, Senator Laurie, Senator Gerlach, and I have agreed on. It's my name only on the bill because we wanted to get it in to meet the deadlines, but their two names will be added by motion unless they tell me otherwise. So in Section 1, right now, local units of government can submit an application to the state auditor for a waiver or a temporary exemption of administrative rule. And what that section allows them to do is to do it as a group so that there's a single application. Section 2 also deals with agency rules and provides a delayed implementation when the rule requires the adoption or amendment of an ordinance so that they have some flexibility in that requirement. Section 3 has to do with the responsibility of counties to deal with election violations that are brought to their or alleged election violations that are brought to their attention. It used to be that all of those were handled by the county attorneys, and we changed the law to allow for the Office of Administrative Hearings to do that, but we did not suggest that the counties be given any relief from their costs with regard to that. So what we did in working with the Office of Administrative Hearings is to look at the sections of the statute that deal with dispute resolution and to allow the Office of Administrative Hearings to fairly allocate the costs of bringing some sort of case before them so that it wasn't always just going to be the county. We don't have any percentages. The county and the affected jurisdiction could agree ahead of time on what the fair distribution would be. If they did not come to an agreement, then the Office of Administrative Hearings would decide, and to do so in an equitable manner. So, for example, if they could decide if it's a small cost that it be 50-50, if it's a township, for example, if it's a township and it's a huge cost and would be an undue burden on the township, they could decide that the fair thing to do would be 90-10. But we would leave it just like it is for the when they're doing other dispute resolutions. And what comes to mind is the way in which annexation issues are, the costs of those are distributed. The Office of Administrative Hearings would have that authority as well. Section 4 deals with the abandoned cemeteries for counties. We added an amendment to allow the same privilege for townships. Section 5 increases from $5,000 to $10,000 the amount of construction and development related fees that would occasion a report to the Department of Labor and Industry. Section 6 removes the statutory limit on compensation for fence viewers and authorizes the town board to require the person who is hiring the fence viewer to post a bond before the viewing takes place. And fence viewers are those folks that are in township law who settle disputes relating to adjoining landowners' responsibilities for, guess what, the maintenance of a fence. Senator Lurie will explain that provision if you need more information.
He's always on the fence.
In Section 7, we changed that by an author's amendment to raise the limit now from $300 to $2,000 as the amount for which individualized itemized accounts need not be published by the county board. We removed removed Section 8 by
yes.
amendment, okay? And we, in the Section 9, we may want to discuss a little bit more. Sections 10, 11, and 12, and 13, and 14 were recommended by the counties as to delete some obsolete language with regard to minimum salary provisions, the authority to establish them by the counties. Sections 15 and 16 have to do with the threshold amounts for contracts and day labors, and it is a cross-reference that is put into the bill. Section 18 involves the pay equity reporting. When it first started, it was 2 years. It then, when we had an economic downturn, it went to 5 years. Then we reverted it to 3 years. And we're giving a little bit of latitude in this bill to the pay equity reporting to make it every 5 years for a period of 4 years. And it is on a revolving a rotation, at least. Unless the political subdivision's most recent report found them not to be in compliance. And if that was the case, then they get no relief. Section 19 adds Anoka and Dakota counties to the metro counties that do not have to prepare a land use plan for unincorporated territory within the county, since those counties do not do so. So they don't have a plan, so they're not required to have one, turn one in. The Section 20 changes the appointing authority for the county examiner of titles from the district court to the county board. Section 21 involves rulemaking again and it provides a moratorium, ending it on July 1st of 2011 with regard to shoreland management rules, EQB rules, and Department of Corrections rules. And then Section 22 has to do with asking the Records Retention Task Force of the Minnesota Clerks and Finance Officers Association to study and report to the legislature on appropriate schedules for the retention of various classes of government records. We found in the statutes that you can go from a couple of years to forever. There are some statutes that require records to be held without any end point, and we're asking this group to come back with some recommendations as to what is the proper, what would be the proper period to retain some language. And then if you look at the end of the bill, in the bill language itself, we have some recommending some repealers. The airline travel credit, we had previously required people to turn in their frequent flyer miles. We decided that is unnecessarily picky, even if they're traveling on state time, so we're not going to require that anymore. In the same way, on 2R, 471-661, we're not going to require out out-of-state travel to be reported by having a recorded vote by a local jurisdiction on out-of-state travel. And I think that came about when a number of years ago the NACO convention, the National Association of County Organizations or something, whatever, of counties, they rotate their meetings around the states. And the and it came time for Hawaii's turn, and there was eyes were raised about this, junket to Hawaii as opposed to a junket to South Dakota, and so this provision was put into law, but it is. Seem to be overly burdensome, and so is proposing to repeal it. The County Facilities Group, I believe that is a redundancy, and it was asked to repeal that. The salaries, fees, and budgets for counties under 75,000 are... The salary laws are being repealed for those minimum salaries again. Same thing for county treasurers, county auditors. I mentioned that when we were going through. And these are obsolete. And county recorders. And then the last repealer also has to do with salaries, fees, and budget. And Mr. Chairman and members, that's the bill. And if you have questions or if you think that any of these mandates should be the mandate relief that is proposed here either causes a burden on some other jurisdiction of local government or is unfair on its face, I hope you'll bring that up and we can discuss it and maybe make some additional changes. And if maybe take those up first, and then I'll bring up the amendment on the deputy registrar's fees.
Thank you, Senator Russ. I know there was a few questions that cropped up during the presentation. Questions of members?
And Mr. Chairman, I may ask representatives from the various jurisdictions to further explain something that is currently in the bill and why it would be helpful or why they actually might even want to take it out.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, on Amendment A6, where you talk about in Section 9, Subdivision 1C, about the four-day work week. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if that, by saying 40-hour work week in there, will that restrict counties if they need to maybe cut down to, say, a 32-hour work week because of what we might be doing to them with program aid? Or
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Olsen, that would be a matter for collective bargaining, either going for 32 hours, a four-day week with eight-hour days, or a four-day week of 10 hours. That's why that language is in there, at the lines 121 through 123, and that's been agreed to, as I understand it, by both the bargaining units and the county as a fair way of solving that issue.
So that would allow them still the flexibility to
they could do 432 if they bargained for it.
Question. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, on page 14, line 19 through 31, where it's referencing the shoreland rules and the EQB rules, it's my understanding that the DNR is in the process right now of updating their shoreland rules. So I'm just curious what conversations you've had with the DNR about these two provisions and how they feel about this. Because
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stephen, I have not heard from them. This is coming at the request of the counties to have a moratorium on the on them. And maybe there's someone here from the counties who can speak to that and whether they have encountered any objection from the EQB or DNR or whatever else. And that Mr. Chairman, Senator Stephen, point out the page again.
14.
Page 14, section 21.
Section
21.
Mr. Chair, Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And to that point, we've made it pretty public that we're pursuing a rural moratorium, and the primary areas are identified here, the DOC, the EQB, and the shoreland rules. I haven't heard from them that this is a particular issue. Our main reason for asking for it is to just delay the implementation of these until we get through the current fiscal crisis. And then we thought that at that time we'd have some more resources to actually go through and react. There's always a cost to the counties when we update our ordinances, et cetera, in response to these. So this isn't stopping that process. We thought just a break to let us get through the current crisis would be adequate for our needs.
And so it's only delayed until July 1st of 2001, so just this biennium.
Correct.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, on your repeals, on the one for out-of-state travel. I had a little tiny bill approved that just took out on the bottom that the policy must be made available for public inspection upon request. I think we just took out reviewed annually. So we did do a little massaging to that. Are you taking the, you're taking the whole thing out, though, is that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, yes.
Senator Gerlach?
Well, okay.
Senator Gerlach?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two items. One is a clarification, because I know there were some quizzical looks when Senator Rest talked about the airline travel credit. Mm-hmm. And just so we're certain on this, there's a mandate that says you have to do certain, you know, that you can't have your frequent flyer miles or something like that. And Senator Rest, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but what you're doing is you're taking the state mandate away. You're not saying that all these people get to keep their frequent flyer miles. You're pushing that onto the counties, and the counties will develop their own policies. It's the local control issue. They'll deal with that locally. There's just the whole idea of this bill is to not have a, you know, some state mandates that we can get rid of. Is that a correct assessment of this particular repeal?
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach, that's how I understand it, but it also states it for the other branches. I mean, it removes a requirement for the other branches of the of government too. It's also repealing the requirement that the legislative, and judicial branches, as well as each political subdivision, develop and implement those policy. So it's getting rid of it completely and the reporting of it. Now, if you want to only have it, if you want to keep it for executive, legislative, and judicial, then we could reinstate that language and just strike the governing body of each political subdivision.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, maybe it's something the committee wants to consider just because we're trying to reduce the mandates, leave it up to them. But I don't know that we as state legislatures in this current environment want to, you know, do a repeal of our own. You know, I mean, maybe we should leave in place
say
our
that
own situation.
Mr. Chairman, since we have a freeze on travel to start with, it won't matter whether you have any frequent flyer miles or not. But if members would like to reinstate that and just take it out for the local governments, that's fine with me.
I guess I would like to point out before we were to act on anything that this is going to finance next, and so it would get a fiscal note, and so we'd get some more information on what has happened with this mandate. You know, they'll specify presumably, you know, how many airline credit miles accrue at what levels and how they are distributed and what the fiscal impacts are. I mean, it was presented to us as a work group that we're trying to eliminate these mandates, that this was kind of an undue burden for them, and the cost of complying with this really outweighed the benefit that the public entity received for doing that. So, I mean, I think allowing the fiscal note to develop would probably be wise, and a lot of these issues will themselves clear.
But Senator Gerlach makes a good point. I mean, the original idea behind this was that if the government is paying for the airline tickets, then any frequent flyer miles belong to the government, because then as they collect them, then they can negotiate better rates, you know, with the airline carriers. If you let the employee keep those frequent flyer mileage, then the employee is getting a benefit that the government paid for. So, you know, it's one thing to do away with the reporting and so forth, but the underlying policy that, you know, is being repealed, I think is still a very good one, that whenever public funds are used to pay for the travel, the credits belong to the government, not to the individual. And I think
question.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, I would agree with you, but it would be my surmise that you just don't claim them. I mean, I don't claim any frequent flyer miles when I go on. I mean, it's not a requirement to have a separate frequent flyer card that you then report those miles on. I just don't put in any number when I'm traveling to a conference. There's no requirement that you have to take them. It's only if you do take them that you have to report them. So I think probably what might happen is, because it's such a big hassle to have a separate frequent flyer mile, that you never get, no one ever gets any benefit from them, because you cannot, or at least you couldn't for a number of years, you couldn't take frequent flyer miles earned by one employee and add them to a frequent flyer miles added for someone else, and then get a frequent flyer ticket to anywhere for the either one of those employees or for none of those employees. And so the requirement then became, in a way, an absurdity, because no one, I would be very surprised if we had anybody in the legislature who got a frequent flyer ticket based on miles that they had accumulated while in the legislature on a independent frequent flyer number. I mean, I don't know anybody that's ever done that. So well, it might sound good in policy, but it's a law without a function.
Senator Betzel.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, there were abuses. The federal government adopted something like this because individuals were collecting, for their personal benefit, frequent flyer mileage that they were using, having accumulated them through official government business. And so that is why the federal government did it. And, you know, I suppose Minnesota adopted it because other states were doing it too. Now, maybe there's differences in how the federal employees book their travel and use them as opposed mm-hmm. to state employees, because within the federal government, you have to go to a centralized office. They're the ones who make the reservations for, in many cases, make the reservations for you, and they handle it. So they were able to negotiate the better rates by capturing those frequent flyer miles. Now, certainly, it's been my experience that, you know, we don't have that kind of system within state government where, you know, everybody kind of books their own, and so I don't know that there's any one place. So there might be a difference between how, but there were reasons for it, and that's why it was originally done. And as I say, maybe it just it's a difference how the state and the federals do things. So.
Well, you know, members, I would just ask you to read the, read what's there. When the public funds are used to pay for airline travel by an elected official, any credits or benefits issued by an airline must accrue to the benefit of the public body providing the funding. And I would submit that in Minnesota, there probably isn't any, because you're not required to ask for the benefit. And I would submit that most people do not. And in the event the issuing airline will not honor a transfer or assignment of any credit or benefit, the individual passenger shall report receipt of the credit or benefit to the public body issuing the initial payment within 90 days of receipt. Now, how many of you have ever done that? I mean, it just seems to be a solution to a problem that no longer exists for us. And given how the airlines deal with their frequent flyer miles, you can't even transfer a ticket anymore. You used to be able to do that. If you bought a ticket, you could, somebody else could use it. And you not only can't do that, but your name on the ticket has to be the same name. I mean, your own same name. You have to have it identical. And then in sub B there, that the governing body has to develop and implement a policy governing accrual of credits or other benefits. I do think we probably have a Senate policy that says you have to, you know, follow this. But again, I would imagine that there are, I would be very surprised if there's any good record of frequent flyer miles being accrued by members of the Senate while on their while on traveling to conferences within the last 10 years. I would just imagine that they're not there. However, that being said, if you want to require this to stay in law that has no effect because people don't do it, then, you know, or you think it's too politically sensitive, then I would say just reinstate it and forget it. I'm comfortable either way.
Senator Roebling, you had a question?
Mr. Chair, I think I would reinstate it myself. You know, there can be a lot of things that go on. For example, if you know you could collect frequent flyer miles, you would always go to the same airline despite the cost if you're going to get reimbursed by the government for it. You know, you wouldn't necessarily shop around for a good price or anything because you'd want to go to the same place and accrue miles. And so I suspect that there would be an incentive not to look for the best deal, perhaps, so you would always, you know, be building up on whichever account that you hold.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Lurie, and I have, no problem. I'd like this bill to have unanimous support. So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Section 15.435 be, that the repeal of that be stricken from the bill.
Everyone understand Senator Rust's motion, essentially that 15.435 be stricken from the
repeal of it be stricken from the bill.
Stricken from the repealer section.
Yeah. Well,
Mr. Chair, like page 15,
Senator
line
Betzel.
Yeah, page 15, line 10. I guess that's where it would be referred to. Thank you.
Yeah, right. On page 15, line 10, strike 15.435 and the
right.
Semicolon. Would be Senator Rust's motion. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Other questions of members? Senator Gerlach.
Thank you. Madam, Mr. Chairman and Senator Rust, of all the flurry of amendments that went on, we put them all on as author's amendments, mm-hmm. but the A4 amendment dealing with the law library,
yes.
I'd like to explore that a little bit because I'll tell you, I think I have a problem with it, and I'll tell you why. And this is it. The way I'm reading it here and from your explanation, maybe I can catch everything, but of course we have the age-old discussion about fees and taxes, and we have a fee for something, for use of something. My thought is that if there's excess funds, well, then the fee ought to be reduced. our goal should be transparency in government, and I think we always try to do that, yet here we're putting in law now another way to somebody's paying a fee for library use, but then, you know, it's going out the back door and somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And I just, that's very, very, that's problematic for me, because, I mean, you could insert any need for it. I mean, it's a defined, you know, child protection services, fine need and all, but I don't know that a library fee, I don't understand the connection between the two.
Mr. Chairman, I would move to reconsider the vote by which the A4 amendment was adopted.
Senator Rust moves to reconsider the vote by which the A4 amendment was adopted.
But
on that motion, on Senator Roebling.
And I agree, but we're not reducing the fee.
We're not.
So that means that the library suddenly has all of this money that they're supposed to be spending, which may not be needed. And so then we're collecting it for not a useful purpose. So from that perspective, I would say it would be better to transfer it to another account that is short on funds unless we can reduce the fee because we have a surplus.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Roebling, oh, I hear what you're saying, but this problem repeats itself, you know, 100 times in government all over the place about where we collect a fee for one thing and it goes somewhere else. And I think that, the county board, I guess, manages this fund for the law library. They're building up a surplus. It's, you know, for transparency purposes, they ought to then address that issue and say where we should reduce our fees for this, you know, for the law library, if that's what they need to do. But to allow them to collect it for one purpose and then spend it somewhere else is that doesn't lead us down the path to more transparent government.
Senator Rose
may be right.
Senator Rose
is wrong.
And maybe Senate Council can help me with this. So do the counties always set their own fee, and are there parameters for that fee?
Be a mandate.
Senate Council?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, I'm getting a shaking head from the county representative, so apparently they don't. I'm not sure how it's set, but I think it's probably a guess as to what the cost of the library services are. But
This is the law libraries, county libraries.
Senator Olsen.
Yeah, I appreciate your question because that's what I was going to ask counsel too. But if I remember right, it's on every ticket. There's a law library line, you know, and it's X amount of dollars. So I do not know if that's established via the state. I suspect it probably is. And so I don't have a problem with this being in there. I think it's actually good to be in there because you mentioned 100 times throughout the state. Well, it happens 87 times in every county for sure, but I don't think it's a bad use of excess law library funds if it's over that amount to roll it back into the legal system in the county. But I guess it would be good to have an answer whether how the law library, how it's assessed, so we had a better idea before it were taken in or
Well, Mr. Chairman, we'll have a little bit of explanation for that, and then we can either vote on my motion to reconsider it or leave it alone. But generally, I'd like everybody to be happy with the bill, and if that means getting things out of it, that's fine with me.
Mr. Chair, Joe Matthews with AMC again. Our attempt with this language was some years these law libraries have a surplus fee, and in those years, rather than building up reserves, which can become sizable, we wanted to direct it to something else that would be related to the legal system, which is why we chose CHIPS. Olmsted County specifically raised this issue with an AMC, and Amy Cockett's here from Olmsted County to talk about some of the more technical questions that you were asking.
Hi, I'm Amy Cockett from Olmsted County. Our finance people have been looking long and hard on how to handle the cuts we now have and we know are coming, along with the new mandate, which is that the public defender is no longer going to take care of the parents in a CHIPS petition. And so that's going to be falling back onto the county property taxpayer. And it came to our attention that our law library now has $162,000 sitting in its in reserves, and $95,000 of that came from last year. And I think that is because we haven't updated a lot of the software. I can't tell you how long it'll last, My guess is as soon as that they find the Board of Trustees that runs the law library finds that there is somebody else that wants the money, they'll probably spend it on things that they want. This may be a window of opportunity for us for perhaps 1 year and maybe two. And it certainly is not something we can consider as an ongoing fund, but right now we are turning over every single rock we possibly can. And with this new mandate with the CHIPS parents, we really, this would, at least in our county, about cover it. I haven't found other counties that know much about this. It may just be there are a few of us that have county law libraries that have this amount of money sitting unused. And a board of trustees, not the county board, decides how to spend this. And the board of trustees includes one judge, the county attorney, somebody from public defense, and somebody from the county board, as well as several attorneys in the region. So that's who makes the decisions.
Senator Gerlach?
Mr. Chairman, I would just ask the committee members to consider that. It's not just the county thing. How do we feel about, those of you who are on transportation, you know about the airport fees that are paid in, and then $15 million was taken out of that airport fund, put into the general fund. It's exactly essentially what's going here. This is a named, it's not the general fund, but it's the same kind of thing. What about the healthcare access fee? How do we feel about the healthcare access fee? It's hard to make an argument that the healthcare access fee, that money is raised for a particular purpose and it should be used for a particular purpose, and then it's being raided. Those examples, like I say, they go on and on. And I feel like this is the same thing. I understand the counties are stretched for cash, of course, and I can certainly understand what you'd be asking for this. But it doesn't serve the public well to add more obfuscation in where money comes in and where money is spent. And the accountability and the transparency that I think that we're all after. The cause is just, the cause is right. It's not the place in this bill or this committee to try to figure out how to fund Child Protective Services.
Mr. Chairman, I renew my motion.
Senator Rest renews her motion to reconsider the vote by which the A4 amendment was adopted. Everyone understand the emotion of the motion? All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
No. Motion does prevail. We now have the A4 amendment back before us again.
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw the A4 amendment.
Senator Rest, did you want to offer the A5 amendment? You had
the
had
A5
that,
amendment.
Set that aside. Was it the
for,
A5? Yeah, the A5
for discussion.
You set aside.
Yes, I will offer the A5 amendment and see how it fares. It is an amendment that would increase the filing fees for deputy registrars and also allow them to be paid by credit card or debit card. And we have people who can testify to the need for that, and then the committee can decide whether the provision belongs in a mandate bill, even if they support it.
Mr. Chair,
Members, just for clarification, Senator Rust, on presenting this bill, figured that there might be some pushback on this, so she saved it and did not offer it as an author's amendment.
Correct.
She's offering it now and offering it up with the opportunity to have discussion on the A5 amendment. So it is not adopted. Now she's just described what it does, and we're going to get testimony, I guess, from Joe Matthews again.
Mr. Chair, Joe Matthews, AMC again. This was a proposal that we've been interested in for a while. We initially asked Working Senator Scoey on the language that would allow us to use credit and debit cards at the Deputy Registrar's Office. Because we were going into this section of statute, it was also suggested that we look at increasing the fees. That's why you see the fee increases here. Jim Hurst is also here on behalf of the Deputy Registrars, and he can talk to this issue as well. But from our perspective, we're really looking to actually benefit those who come in to these offices to purchase various items or get government services and let them use a debit or credit card. The biggest barrier has been that current law would require the government unit or the Deputy Registrar itself to absorb those fees. And so we're trying to find a way in which that can be passed through to the consumers who choose to use those as a form of payment.
Thank you. Mr. Hurst, was it?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I represent the Minnesota Deputy Registrars Association. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss briefly, I know time is valuable, just to explain the merits of the amendment that's before you for your consideration. First, to the credit and debit card issue. The deputy registrars have long wanted to be able to offer this type of transaction service to customers that come into their offices. Unfortunately, as Joe mentioned, the biggest hurdle is the fact that all of these transactions usually require anywhere from 2 to 4% of the entire amount charged to be charged also on the vendor, in which case this would be the deputy registrar. So, for example, if you were to come in with a renewal tab notice from the state that let's say $99, which is a common amount for relatively most vehicles in the state that are between 3 and 5 years of age. There's a $99 fee for the state of Minnesota. There's also the $4.50, which is the handling fee, which is retained by the deputy registrar. In the eyes of the credit card industry, that total transaction of $103.50 would be subject to the 2 to 3%. So simple math would suggest the amount charged would be somewhere in the range of $2 to $3. The state of Minnesota, who is the recipient of the $99, and we turn that over within 24 hours to the state, they certainly have no interest in paying their share out of the $99 to cover this, and I can understand why. But by the same token, if the deputy offices were to absorb this cost, it would be at least half of our current filing fee that we're already struggling to make ends meet with the existing $450. And certainly in other transactions, the amount of the credit card or debit card transaction would easily be in excess of what we collect. The language here pertaining to the credit cards is one of two options that the Department of Public Safety came up with in a recent task force report to the legislature last month. Basically, they offered up two suggestions. On one hand, either raise all fees, all taxes and fees on registrations and motor vehicle to absorb such costs, or on the flip side, and quite honestly, it'd be very hard to quantify just where that magic number would be because of the vast differences in the amounts of the transactions. Or do as a what is suggested here, a pay-as-you-go approach, whereby the customer is informed if they want to use a credit or debit card to do so, they would have to cover the exact costs that are incurred to conduct that transaction by credit card or debit card. And so the language here reflects that aspect of it. In regards to the fees, of course, the deputies have been struggling for a number of years to maintain their operations. For your information, there are about 174 deputy offices in the state of Minnesota serving the nearly 5 million citizens. That is an appropriate amount based on the size of the state, both geographically and given metro versus rural considerations. And truly, consolidation is really not an option for the deputy registrar network out there. However, with the deputy registrars, roughly two-thirds of these offices are public offices, meaning they are operated under the auspices of counties or cities. And the other one-third are done by private individuals who have been appointed by the state, because the county as well as the city have the option to tell the state, no, we really don't want to pursue having our own license bureau. And so when that happens, then private entities or individuals are appointed to do that work and fill the void. One of the reasons why cities and counties may not wish or may not want to pursue this is the fact that these offices only operate and can only cover their expenses, labor and material and equipment and everything, by these fees that are raised. Unfortunately, we're seeing more and more public offices having to turn to their county boards or their city councils and saying, council members or board members, we didn't retain enough in our fees to do the work that we've conducted to cover all the costs, and therefore they need to be subsidized by the county board or the city council, depending on which entity has the license bureau. That, unfortunately, comes off of the property tax rolls that those communities have, which I'm sure they would very much rather apply those funds in other areas. Because deputy registrar offices, operate in this manner, we would very much appreciate the consideration of a modest fee increase of this nature. The last time the renewal fee was increased was 2001, and then it was only raised by $1. The titling transactions that are currently at $8.50 went to that amount 4 years ago when it went from $7 to $8.50. I should point out that at that time we were advocating for something closer to $10 simply because of the demands that our offices have. I realize I've been going on perhaps beyond what is necessary, but with that in mind, we humbly seek your support and consideration of both matters here in this amendment.
Thank you. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hertz, we deal with this one a lot in transportation and with Ms. McCormick at DPS, but my understanding is that at this point in time, Visa has not accepted this. I believe other credit card companies have agreed to allow a surcharge added, and Visa being probably the big dog in the credit card world. You know, there's two thoughts of school on that. If we allow this to happen, I'm sure they'll say we have an opportunity here for revenue and they'll go along with it, or they won't. But do you have any idea on where Visa's at on this?
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Olsen. You are correct. This approach has not been adopted by Visa. However, it has been approved by MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. Certainly, the department does have concerns that if Visa is not on board, this is all for naught. We have, however, also discovered that most individuals, while 60% of the market is Visa, most individuals have more than one credit card, and most individuals not only have a Visa but also a MasterCard, myself included. I wish that wasn't the case because I owe them both some money, but certainly we feel that up until this point we have had to tell our customers, sorry, we don't take credit cards or debit cards. And for us to change that to say, sorry, we don't take Visa, it's somewhat in our vocabulary already to deny, credit cards across the board, to say we deny one of them. We're willing to do that for the better overall.
Mr. Chairman, I think we need
Senator
to act on this
yes.
amendment one way or the other. We still have a couple more bills to do, and
yes.
I do want to get them
I know.
To them
Senator
tonight.
Roebling?
Your bills and my bills.
Yes, I know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have no problem with the fee imposed for credit card use, and I don't care if Visa doesn't get any business out of this. It's just fine. They can change their policies, and then they can get business, because that really annoys me. And they try and hide their fees, and like customers believe that they're not actually paying for them, but they are indeed, and I think this points it out quite well. However, I am concerned that this is a 25% increase in fees for going from $4.50 to $6. And that, that's a lot. I mean, it seems like a small amount of money, but it's a large percentage. And I haven't heard anything from my deputy registrars. And I remember when we changed it last time, they had tried for several years to get it changed. And by the time we changed it, they really needed it. But I have not heard that this is desperately needed at this level.
Mr. Chairman, I would amend the motion to reflect Senator Roebling's concern and to strike the new language on 1.6 and 1.8, but to allow them to use credit cards and having that appropriate surcharge without doing the increase.
Okay, so we don't really need to vote on that. We're just changing Senator Rest's amendment
Well, yes, I will incorporate that change
in your
amendment that I make, that the we'll strike the new language on 1-6 and 1-8.
Other questions on the remaining portion, the section B there in the amendments? Senator Carlson.
Maybe you can clarify for me. I believe if you go online and you get your tabs online, the state is paying the fee.
Mr. Chairman, if I may respond, and Senator Carlson, thank you for that question. Credit card fees can be imposed in this manner for non-face-to-face transactions, such as a credit card sale over the internet or over the phone, which is how the state of Minnesota offers their online tab renewal service, which incidentally that is exclusive with the state of Minnesota.
It's face-to-face that you can't do it.
It's only with face-to-face transactions that you cannot offer the surcharge, or actually it's not a surcharge, but rather charge the amount that is cost. If it's a non-face-to-face, you can already do this. But because our operations are all face-to-face and because we cannot do an internet-based service, that's why we are seeking this consideration.
Senator Rust moves.
Good memory.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move the A5 amendment, incorporating on lines 1-6 and 1-8 to strike the new language.
And reinserting the stricken language. All those in favor of the newly formed A5 amendment, aye.
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 All those opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I don't have any further.
On the bill itself, any further questions of members? Senator?
To point, Senator Roebling made a point in the last amendment, A5. It's actually a 33% increase from 450 to 6. It's 150 plus 1, so it's 33%, not 20%.
Thank you.
That's all right. Other questions, comments of members? Seeing none, anyone in the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 1544? Seeing none, Senator Rust moves that Senate File 1544, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Finance. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Senator Rust. Senator Rust, Senate File 80.
Mr. Chairman, there were three bills with regard to the Campaign Finance Board that are on the schedule for today. But what I am proposing to do is to put the provisions that would remain in the bill all on Senate File 80, and it needs to go to the Judiciary Committee. So I'd like to explain what's in the provisions, and then as it will be in our, Mr. Bodden has a delete all amendment. And then there are a couple of other.
Okay, so first we will ignore the subcommittee report.
We're not going
on
to take up
ADA,
the subcommittee report.
Take up the subcommittee report?
No.
We're not going to take. Okay.
Mr. Bodden, am I explaining it correctly?
She's incorporating.
Yes. Okay. So the while that's being distributed, I will explain. The underlying bill is Senate File 80. Senate File 80 proposes to put a limit on judicial contribution. No, I just know what it says. To put a limit on judicial contributions at $2,000. Under current law, there is no limit on judicial contributions. There is all other kinds of regulations, reporting, et cetera, for judicial candidates, but not a contribution limit. In December, the group that sets the canons for the judges adopted it in their canons. However, it seems to me that just like we are subject and other candidates are subject to a contribution limit, that so too should people who are running for the judiciary. The so that part was Senate File 80, and Mr. Goldsmith is here to talk about Senate File 425, those portions of 425, which are now part of this bill, that is the Campaign Finance Board's policy bill, which was heard in the subcommittee. And the, let's see, in the bill.
Oh, Mr. Chair, before we move off of Senate File 80, I do have one question about that. Senator Rest, you are indicating that, you know, we're putting a cap on contributions to judicial offices because there are none right now.
That's correct.
However.
And that would be in, that will now be in Section 14 of the Delete All Amendment.
Right. With some other changes to that section, it appears.
Yes.
However, it's my understanding that the reason why we can limit campaign contributions is because for the other offices, we do have some public financing for them, and that's the trade-off. If you agree to the limitations, then you can receive the public financing for those candidates.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, that's wrong.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Regardless of whether you accept the public financing, you still have to abide by the contribution limits. What you do not have to abide by is the spending limits.
Okay.
So if you accept the spending limits, then you get public financing. But everybody has to abide by the contribution limits. And it was just that the judges had no limit. Mr. Chairman, so that is in Section 14. I had a bill that was Senate File 1141 that made a number of changes in the campaign finance law that talked about what party units could spend their money on in terms of what had to be done for the first filings, to changing the checkoff to an opt-out rather than an opt-in, et cetera. The only provision that remains from Senate File 1141 that is now part of the Delete All Amendment for Senate File 80 is Section 14. So Section 14 is all of Senate File 80, and it's the only section that's left of Senate File 1141. And what it does is, I believe, modernizes and recognizes the increasing costs of campaigns and our ability to raise the money to conduct them. And it also sets at a single level the other than governor and lieutenant governor, the other constitutional officers, the limits for the other constitutional officers, rather than having a third tier of contributions for the Secretary of State and the state auditor. So it brings up the Secretary of State and the State Auditor to the same level in terms of contributions as the Attorney General, setting that at 1,000 in an election year and 200 in other years. It does not change the limit for candidates for governor lieutenant governor, keeping them at 2,000. Why is there any difference to start with? I think that was proposed in the past because the race for governor and lieutenant governor is often the most competitive race in the state, and so it was set that way. For under in 7-11, I'm proposing to raise the limit for candidates for state senator from 500 to 750 in an election year and 250 in other years. I'm not proposing that there be any change in the disclosure laws. And then for candidate for state representative, maintaining 500 in an election year for the office sought and $125 in the other year. That would mean that in the other years, since we have the disclosure law saying that anything above $100 needs to be disclosed, as we all know now, for 3 years, we disclose nothing, not anything, other than a campaign contribution from a political party, and some of us do receive those. That is the only thing that is disclosed. I think that is a by, it's a kind of like a by benefit, but also I think that what I'm sure that some of you find as you're doing things in your Senate district with your House members is right now, let's say you do some sort of report and you each get a $100 contribution from wherever, maybe somebody in your district, maybe not. And if a report costs $200, you pay half of it. And the House member pays half of half. And so the report costs $200. You pay $100. They pay $50. So from a $100 contribution, they get to keep $50. And it just seems to me that there should be some acknowledgement in the system for that, and also the fact that it is it's more and more difficult to find increasing numbers of donors at particularly the limits in the non-campaign years to pay for what are generally a lot of non-campaign costs, legislative surveys, legislative questionnaires. So this provision here combines Senate File 80 and the only provision that survives from Senate File 1141. And then the rest of the bill is the Campaign Finance Board's provisions. And Mr. Goldsmith can speak to it. We do have, is a change in here? There was some concern raised about in the subcommittee or after the subcommittee met, some concerns raised about the electronic filing requirement that was due to take place in 2012, and scenarios were described about information being made available that would. That if you reported it electronically, that the data that could be mined from that would give an unfair advantage to particularly a caucus or political party with regard to someone. If you filed on time and the other political party did not, they would have access to information about what you were doing in the pre-general election and you would not have access necessarily to theirs. So, for example, if the Republican Party filed on time and the DFL party decided to wait until after, pay the fine and wait until after the election to put forth that information, that you were giving an unfair advantage to one side or the other. So Mr. Goldsmith has been working to resolve that issue, and what we've come up with is in section 12, which would say that when we move to electronic filing, that the information is not to be made available to anyone until both parties have filed. So then everybody's on a level playing field, and if you want to move forward from that, fine. In addition, there are some of us who file our reports very early, candidates who file them very early. I file my year-end report usually by January 4th or 5th. I do not wait until the end of the month because I do it electronically right now. There was a concern also about revealing that information on other than a level playing field, and I believe that there is on page 11. It's page 5, section 11, with regard to candidates. Where is it? That a report that would be filed way before the deadline would be considered non-public data, so it wouldn't be revealed until 8 o'clock on the day following the day the report was due. So if I file January 4th, it still would not be made. I could have all month long to file. It still would not be made available to others until February 1st at 8 a.m. So the information all goes into the public domain at the same time. And I think that as we move forward with this electronic filing and being able to manipulate data and to file the data, that we need to be mindful of having a level playing field for everyone. So other than that provision, the bill is the bill that the Campaign Finance Board brought forward. It also includes Senator Scheid's bill that added the necessary utensils and supplies. We actually passed it on the consent calendar today to have it in more than one place so that bill does not get lost, including that as a non-campaign expenditure. In section 1, that is getting rid of or responding to the Supreme Court decisions about what constitutes independent expenditures. Section 3, we discussed it proposes changes to late filings for lobbyists and what the consequences are. In Section 4, there is a clarification of informational material that has a resale value of $5 or less that goes along with the services, or the plaques and the trinkets, et cetera. And Section 5, I'm not exactly sure what section, maybe I think it's the noticing provisions, once again, that can be done by certified mail. And the same thing with Section 6, it's changing just the reporting about the economic interest statements. The forms now, when you're filing about an organization, would include an email address for the candidates or organizations. Section 8 also has to deal with giving notice, shortening the time of getting notice for a bill. We also allow for, in Section 9, if someone does not have an email address, the Campaign Finance Board may grant an exemption to that requirement. And the reason for that is the Campaign Finance Board, if people are voluntarily providing those, is able to send out notices to candidates and to organizations electronically, and it gets to be a money-saving device However, if they don't have one, they'll also send it out otherwise, and they would grant a waiver to those that cannot provide one. And then I've already discussed Section 10, which is the beginning in 2012 election, which will be a time probably when a number of people will choose not to run because that's the new districts, et cetera. So that's a good turnover time for electronic filing. And and they can give, the board can give exception to electronic filing for a good cause. And I don't think there's any more major policy proposed by them, except if you look at Section 16, withholding of the public subsidy, you can't get the public subsidy unless you file a report. That is what the thrust of that is. If you don't file it, the report by the due date, then the candidate will not be paid the public subsidy for that election. And that gets around the problem of someone not filing the report, getting the public subsidy, and then come to find out that they don't qualify for it, or there's some ambiguity. And that's about it in terms of the policy that's in the bill. We've worked with the Campaign Finance Board since the fall to solicit recommendations from them for changes in the law, talked with a number of members, and came up with those three bills that I think they're not so big that they can't be included in one bill.
So we're gonna combine these three. We're not going to adopt the subcommittee reports, I guess, but I'd like to just say for the record that I think each of these provisions, other than those ones that you described, I think Section 11 did go before the subcommittee and came back to the full committee with a recommendation to pass. Is that correct?
Yes,
Senator.
The provisions did.
I think you described Section 11, the release of the reports, holding it back for a while, came up after the subcommittee report.
Yes,
but otherwise,
after
Senate
the subcommittee reports with concerns that were raised in the House,
right,
in
okay,
particular.
And Senate File 425
and the political
Senate File
parties.
1141. Everything was seen by the subcommittee and came back with a recommendation to pass, is my understanding.
Right.
Questions on the bill? Senator Roebling.
Thank you.
Amendment.
I have some questions. Now, if they cannot file a report, and I can understand the January report, I don't have a problem if that information gets delayed, but the ones that are due, like, before a primary or before a general election, and one party can keep all of that, by one party's delay, the public doesn't get to see anybody's reports. And the penalty for delaying is just not strong enough to give them incentive. I'm afraid, in particular, I don't know if candidates will do it as much, but political parties will probably do it more so. But candidates may do it too. So isn't there a report due about 10 days before the election?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, yes, there is, a pre-general report. I think that if you file on time, you get to be a party or a caucus. You get to be proud of that, and it is. I think it's a PR blunder for the parties not to file the entities not to file on time, so that the information can be disclosed. But Mr. Goldsmith can speak further to the actual experience that they have. And I just know that as a matter of you know, just the public presentation of myself. I'm gonna file my report on time, and I don't want to be known as somebody who always files their report late and has to pay a penalty because of it.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, Gary Goldsmith. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board, and I'd like to take this opportunity to just elaborate on sections 11 and 12, which are the two sections that did not go before the subcommittee. Section 11 deals with all reports filed by everybody at any time, and it says that those reports are non-public until 8 a.m. the day after the due date. That's the process that the Campaign Finance Board currently uses for releasing the reports to our internet site. In other words, we accumulate them as they come in, and then they all get released at 8 a.m. the day after the due date. And this is so there's not a disincentive to filing early, because we prefer to have those reports come in over a longer period of time. And every report that's in at that time from every candidate and every minor party unit, every PAC, will be, in fact, public data and on the internet at that time. The more limited provisions that Senator Rest was speaking to apply only to a very limited group of party units. And let me explain those in a little more detail, and these are in Section 12. A candidate report, we can anticipate certain things. First of all, the candidate is targeting the candidate's own district, so we don't need to worry about where the money's going. And secondly, for an active candidate with a realistic campaign, the spending eventually is going to be somewhat approaching the spending limit if the candidate is able to raise those funds. So there aren't going to be a lot of surprises in candidate filings. On the other hand, the caucuses and the state party units target specific districts, and no one knows up until a report is filed what districts they might be targeting, where they might be making independent expenditures, and what elections they're specifically trying to influence. The concern was that with those actually six committees, it would be the two biggest state party units, the two House caucus committees, the biggest, well, there are only two right now, and the two Senate caucus committees. Those committees expressed a need to not have their data mined in a way that they couldn't do the corresponding data mining of the opponent's report. So what the Section 12 says is that with respect to those three sets, and they're grouped, if one party, one unit in one of those groups, let's say the DFL House Caucus, doesn't file its report on time, then neither of the two House Caucus reports would be public data from the board's perspective until they were both filed. Now, nothing precludes the party from releasing its own report. Likewise, specifically, the board is permitted to disclose the fact that one committee did file and that the other didn't, and thus the reason the data isn't public is because of the non-filer. So that protects filing from by one and not the other. The second aspect of Section 12 is that if one of these six groups, again, by pairs, so a caucus committee not filing doesn't suppress the filing of state party units or of the other caucus parties, only the corresponding member of party unit of the own caucus. The other provision is that if one of these in a group files electronically and the other files on paper, the board will publish a visual image of the electronic report but not publish electronic data. So you'll be able to look at both reports in the same format, but you wouldn't be able to data mine from the electronic one when you couldn't from the paper filing. The board will data enter data from the paper report, and once the same electronic data is available from both, then they'd both be released in electronic format.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Mr. Goldsmith, what is the penalty to the political caucus or party unit then? Is it just after so many days, it's $5 a day up to $100. It's the only financial penalty they get, and they could absorb that, I think, rather easily, because these are pretty big funds sometimes, and yet the public is still without any information, possibly before the general election. And I guess that's my concern here. I think there should be a bigger penalty for to incent them to get their reports in so they can both be released. I understand the concern about releasing one and not the other, but I think that we should have a bigger penalty to get them in.
Senator Roebling, I wouldn't be opposed to that, but it didn't become part of this bill. We were just trying to respond to concerns about at least having a level playing field if indeed you are doing everything according to the deadlines and not trying to game the system.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Senator Lori, we can continue that discussion, but Mr. Bodern, the effective dates for the we have the
that one's correct there.
Which one?
This one here.
The effective date for the
wait until after
for Section 10 does not. The effective date for Section 12 is July 1, 2012, and that's that has to do with electronic filing. But then it looks like that in Section 10, we need to have the same effective date of 2012 as well. Otherwise, it would be August 1st of 2009. Mr. Chairman, I would move. Did we vote on this?
We have not.
I would move to include in the delete all amendment to repeat line 616 and 617 as an effective date provision for Section 10.
So Senator Rust just incorporates that amendment into.
Right.
Oral amendment into her A1 amendment. Okay. Mr. Bodern, does that work well?
Mr. Chairman,
good
that's
on
fine.
That one? Okay. Mr. Goldsmith had some thoughts to add.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and back to Senator Roebling. With regard to the late filing fees, the board has recognized for a long time that the $5 per day late filing fee, which actually only applies to the year-end report, and a non-election year report is completely insignificant. Senator Rest is correct that it's the stigma of being a late filer that really creates the incentive. The late filing fee for pre-general and pre-primary election reports is $50 a day. Unfortunately, my discussions with units that would maybe want to file late suggest that even that's not significant. It's a cost of doing business if they really want to be late. The board typically doesn't recommend levels. We leave those policy questions to the legislature. But we do believe that the provision that's included in Section 12, that the board would publicize the fact that one report is in and one report is not in, and it's because of the non-filer being late that this data is not available to the public, would be a great incentive for that non-filer to get their report in.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would agree that that would be a good incentive for candidates, but I don't think it's a good incentive for caucuses or parties. Candidates have a lot more at stake personally and individually, and I think that they would. When you said it's $50 a day for the pre-election reports, does that start immediately after the deadline, or do they have that 10-day grace period or whatever it is in the January report?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, it starts on the fourth day after the report was due. It's $50 a day up to a maximum of $500.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest, we may have to work on an amendment on that.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, I would not be adverse to that, but I do think that this is a beginning step in and at least doing this, even if we're not addressing the fines here, it does create a more level playing field.
Good. Any other questions of members? Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, are you looking at
any similar types of incentives for instance, PACs, any kind of independent expenditures that are not the party and not the candidate, such that, for instance, if there's a particularly interesting race that where a PAC is going to put a lot of money into it, you know, is there anything there that can be done?
Mr. Chairman, we do expect compliance, but unlike political parties who have true counterparts and candidates who have true counterparts, PACs don't necessarily have, a one-for-one opposition PAC on a single issue. I mean, there aren't PACs that are a PAC in support of a particular candidate and a PAC in opposition to a particular candidate. So I think the lines are a little bit fuzzier there.
Senator Betzold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Resta, I was doing some quick math looking at the adjustments in the contribution to the House and Senate candidates, and I guess, we've recognized over the years that during a four-year period, a House member could raise from a single source, I think, $1,200, $500 in two election years and $100 in two other years, whereas during that same four-year period, a candidate for the Senate could only raise $800, the $500 in one, the election year, and then $300 the other years. And then if you look at a 10-year cycle, a House candidate, as I work out the numbers, currently could raise $3,000 from that one source, whereas a senator could only raise $2,200 from the Senate, just because of, the election year versus the non-election year. It's interesting that under your proposal, now the senators can raise more money from the single source. We could raise over a 10-year period, $3,400 from one source, whereas the House candidates, $3,125, which I'm fine with. I'm just suggesting, candidates in the other body may, I don't know why the difference has been, but that's just, it's just interesting to see that there's
Mr. Chairman and Senator Betzel, in talking with some members of the House, I have not really found, maybe that needs to be adjusted a little bit there, but I have not really found any pushback on the notion that the Senate limits ought to be a bit higher than the House ones because we have wider distributions, and if you only have three people who can give you money, I mean, if you just in a theoretical real world or theoretical non-real world, that it's just an attempt to address that. It might well be that we might want to make the non-campaign years be 125 for both. But this is the scheme I came up with to start with, and certainly I'd be open to having it modified.
If somebody thought it was, we'll go to conference.
Sure. Yeah, if somebody thought it was fairer.
It's just, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I just think it's, you should just double-check the numbers. I mean, I like the way the direction you're going, and simply because, as you said, the candidates for the Minnesota Senate do have to campaign in a larger area, but so far under the current scheme, we've been able to raise, get less money from a single source than the House candidates who have a much smaller area to run in. So, it's just something you should just, figure out. And not only just go 4 years, because the Senate, as you know, has to go 4-4-2. So I think just if you average out over a 10-year period, where the candidates are. So just, just keep that in mind as you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brunson, thank you for making that calculation, and I'll pay attention to that.
Senator Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest, are you planning to make any changes in what's classified as the major donors with the 750?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience care to speak either in favor or in opposition? Seeing none, Senator.
So
we need to vote on the amendment before us, the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, so I would renew my motion to adopt the A1 amendment with that additional effective date language for Section 10.
Incorporating the oral amendment. All those in favor of Senator Rust's motion to adopt the A1 amendment with the oral changes, all those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll have the bill in shape.
No.
And now Senator Rust moves Senate File 80, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary.
That's correct.
All in favor of that motion? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Okay. We're only paying attention to one section of it, really, and that is an advisory group. Really fast.
We can go really fast. Madam Chair and members.
Senator Loring.
Senate File 854 before us. This is a disability providers bill for some reform ideas to help the disability community, long-term care community, move forward in a better and more sustainable fashion. Really, there was a couple of sections. I have an A2 amendment that we've been working on with
Senator
Tom
Loring
Potter.
Moves adoption of the A2 amendment. It's an author's amendment.
This is not an author's amendment.
No,
so let me just describe what it does.
Okay.
There's three sections of the bill that would have brought it before us. This really compresses it to
it's
one
not.
Section that would come before
I
us.
See.
It deletes Section 9, which would have come before us, and it kind of incorporates some of that language in this amendment. The sections before us are on page 13, sections 12 and 13 of the bill. 13 is actually deleted in this amendment and restructured under the Common Service Menu for Home and Community-Based Service Waiver Programs. And section 12, B, C, and D, actually I need to incorporate an oral amendment to the author's amendment on line,
or at least to the amendment you're going to offer.
To the A2 author's amendment on
amendment.
Line 1.8,
okay.
I need to change the line 22 to line 18.
Do what now?
Line 1.8 on the A2 author's amendment.
Yes.
It says page 13, delete lines 22 to 24. That needs to read delete lines 18 to 24.
Oh, I see. On line 1.8 of the amendment, page 13, delete lines 18 to 24.
Yes, and insert.
Rather than 22. So strike 22 and insert 18.
And so essentially, if we adopt this amendment, what we'll have is the Commissioner of Human Service collaborating with the Commissioner of Health and convening work groups that already exist to create a single set of standards, and then to consult with ICFMR providers to work on the ICFMR report that was issued just in December. And really, under this new formation, there's no new work group formed or no new commission. We're just giving directions to the commissioner as to how to proceed with existing work groups. And we've been working with Mr. Bodern, Senate Counsel, and believe that it should pass muster on all of the 9 criteria that we impose here in state and local.
Are there questions for Senator Lurie about the A2 amendment and the purpose that it serves here? Any questions? Seeing none,
I move the A2 amendment incorporating
the A2 amendment to Senate File 854. Incorporating the oral amendment on line 1.8 of the amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Once again, Senator Loring, the bill came to this this committee because of the expert panel group in your Section 9, at which you have now changed.
Right.
Is that correct? Is there anyone who... I see that you have Mr. Nelson with you, but is there anyone who wants to speak in favor or in opposition to this bill?
Mr. Nelson was here just to
answer
questions.
If you have any
questions
for Mr. Nelson. Seeing none, Senator Lori moves that Senate File 854, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Members, I neglected to point out one section in the campaign finance bill that that I had been considering of having a provision that would allow checkoff dollars to be used to fund the campaign finance board. But instead of proposing that, I asked the campaign finance board in a section of the bill to study the feasibility of that and to report back to the legislature, and I failed to mention that. I don't think it's a controversial provision, but maybe we do want to start thinking about having the checkoff be a part of the funding of our campaign finance boards, of that system, rather than general fund dollars for their budget. So it's not in the bill except as requesting a study. If you have any questions, you can ask me about it. There being no further business before the committee, we meet next on Wednesday. And we'll be meeting on Friday as well, as we're coming up against the deadlines for the end of next week. There being no further business before the committee, thank you very much for your attention and patience today. We stand adjourned.